please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It is Oliver from the Fairfax Speakers Group in Wilmington, Delaware.
Hi, my name is Oliver. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Oliver.
I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be anywhere where I'm alive and sober and able to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. This program is the greatest gift that anyone has ever given me or will ever give me, and the only way that I can keep it is to try and give it back to the best of my abilities. You know, on page 124 of the big book, it says that showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. And so everything that I went through, everything that I did to myself, and everything that I did to the people around me is something that in God's hands can be turned into gold. And it's the most valuable possession that I have today, and that's my experience. And that's what I'm here to offer. I'd like to get through my drunk log as quickly as possible, though, so I can talk about 10, 11, and 12, which is, that's where the good stuff is. That's where the rewards really are in this program, and they're beyond estimation. Let me see. I have a sobriety date. It's November 9th of 2006. I have a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor. I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring other men. Some of them sponsor other men. Some of them sponsor other men. Some of them sponsor other men. And some of them sponsor other men. I've lost track of how many generations of sponsorship there are going on down there. It's wonderful. It's wonderful just to see the fellowship growing up around me and to know that God is working in the lives of everybody that that I'm seeing in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very grateful to Teddy for coming up here tonight with me. He is my great-grand sponsee, I think. Hey, Teddy. And I'm grateful to Lauren for asking me to speak here tonight. Thank you, Lauren. And again, thank you all for being here. Let's see. Well, enough about that stuff. I was born in Wilmington, grew up in a town called Newark, Delaware, which is right near the Maryland border. Household had no kind of religion to speak of in it. Anyone who talked about God, anyone who believed in God, I knew them slightly from family relations. I knew them more from television and movies. And they were affectionately known in my household as stupid morons. The household religion was essentially communism, for lack of a better term. Now I'll tell you this anecdote. But when I was 11 years old, my dad said that he loved me, he would always be behind me. And I said, what if I become a Republican, Dad? And he stared at me and he said, well, then I'll be 300 yards behind you with a rifle. Thanks, Dad. I love you, too. The real household religion, the real force that ran the lives of the adults around me was alcohol. And I didn't even know what alcohol was yet. I just knew that something about this stuff was magical. I mean, I'm a little kid, and I just know that the adults come home beaten down by whatever it is grown-ups do all day. And they would get, you know, beer out of the fridge, or they'd drink some of that stuff in those bottles over there, and it would brighten them right up. I just knew that there was something in that bottle that was magical, and someday I was going to be a part of that experience. And I know that it mattered more than I did. Alcohol mattered more than I did in the lives of the adults around me. And I knew that because the first time my dad laid hands on me that I can remember, I was crawling around and I knocked his drink over. And so I knew that this stuff really mattered. It matters. Again, I don't matter. Alcohol matters. Alcohol runs their lives. Alcohol is the name of the game. I don't remember my first drink because, you know, that kind of household, you know, you're always taking sips here and there, you know, little drinks. I can just remember that my mom would pound a beer and say, get me another beer, and I'd just chug the backwash while I was going to get another beer. And I was too afraid to take a beer and steal one for myself, but I knew that someday I would be grown up and I could have as much of this stuff as I wanted. I knew it was magical, and I learned to like the taste for as long as I can remember, for as long as I could walk. And real quick, the only other thing about my childhood that matters, and you haven't figured this out yet, is that I had no understanding of what I was doing in this world, no framework for why we're here, and I was consumed with fear all the time. Every moment of every day, I was terrified. I was terrified of myself, terrified of you, terrified of whatever kind of God created this, and I wanted nothing to do with it. Waking up sober, wishing I were dead, every day for as long as I can remember. My first suicide attempt, I was 8 years old, and it didn't get any better from there. I just had no understanding of what you wanted from me or what I was supposed to do with you. And so I got some really warped views about that I'll touch on briefly later. Mostly about how life is about clawing your way to the top of the pack and taking what you want and what you think you need from the people around you, which is a pretty sick and distorted view of things, frankly, but that is what it is. Served me well, right? Got me into AA. So life didn't go too well for me. I was just retreating all the time into self, running away from everybody around me, isolating and alone, terrified. There's a guy named Richard Peabody, wrote a book in 1930 called The Common Sense of Drinking. And a line in that book was, drinking is a manifestation of the wish to escape from reality. And I had that wish long before I really discovered alcohol and what alcohol did for me. I was escaping reality in comic books, role-playing games, video games, novels, anything I could find, anything that a prepubescent child in my socioeconomic circumstances could find, I was using to get out of reality. And then I discovered alcohol, and alcohol really did the trick. And the great thing about alcohol was that fear was completely gone. I wasn't afraid of anybody in this world when I was drinking. I just loved it so much. I understood finally what the grown-ups were so obsessed with, because the biggest guy in this room, if I'm drunk, I'll take him on if I have to. I'll take you all on if I'm drunk. I don't care. To win. I'm not saying I'm going to win. I'm not tougher when I'm playing. I'm just crazier. But I'll take you all on, and we'll fight. I can vaguely remember getting in fights with guys twice my size who thought it was hilarious, and they were just beating me up, and I'm jumping back up. Like, come on, Skeller. My brother is 6'4", and he used to, he's one of us, he used to rob drug dealers to get what he needed, and he said that I was the scariest person he ever drank with. And I said, why is that, Matt? And he said, well, because every single time you were in a blackout, you would hit me, or you would assault me in some way. Apparently, I was losing fights I don't even remember getting in. I would punch him or hit him with a bottle or something. He said one time at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he was walking across the front lawn with a pool cue, and I ran out of the house and started attacking him. He started bashing me over the head with this pool cue. Until a neighbor came over and tried to call the cops. And I have no memory of any of that happening. I don't remember getting beaten up with a pool cue. And if I'd known that at the time, if you told me that the next day, I would have laughed it off and said, well, too bad. That sucks for you, I guess. But I need to drink more than I need to not assault my own brother. So we're just going to go with that. Because alcohol works. It works perfectly. I'm not afraid anymore, especially of women. Oh, my God. Sober, I am totally terrified of any woman in this room. I'm afraid to walk up to you. I'm afraid to say hi to you. Afraid to look you in the eye. Afraid to ask you out. Oh, my God, forget. Drunk, I don't care. I don't care if your boyfriend's right there. I'll ask you out. I'm a brave man when I'm drunk, you know. And begin to fight. Well, we just covered that. You know. So this is more of like late high school or early college when I really discovered what alcohol can do for me. The problem was the people around me quickly discovered that they didn't like the way that I was when I drank, and I vaguely remember some of it. Like, I can remember one time I was in a restaurant with my friend. We got into some kind of argument about God. I don't know what it was. He threatened me in some way, and I didn't feel like fighting him because he was my friend. So I did what I'd done a couple times in high school in those situations, which I engaged in self-violence. And so I just stabbed myself in the neck with a fork. I stabbed myself in the arm with pencils in high school. I mean, it was crazy. What I figured out early on is that if I inflict harm on myself, other people won't want to fight me. And it worked perfectly. I stab myself in the neck with a fork. If I don't want to fight you, you back away. I have no idea why that works. It's just like, okay, you think it would be easier to beat me up because I already just inflicted serious damage on myself. But people back off when you stab yourself in the neck with a fork. You know what you will. If you get nothing else out of tonight, here's a little tip for you. Unfortunately, they keep backing away. So I found myself with very few friends by the time I was 18, 19 years old. Nobody really wanted to be around me except for people who drank like I drank. And I, again, felt like I was on top of that group because I was better than them. You know, I'm waking up with the shakes at 19 years old at 5 o'clock in the morning, taking shots of pop off to go back to sleep, but I'm better off than that other guy who's huffing dust off. And, you know, I'm drinking, and I'm pretty much a pure alcoholic, so I'm better than that other guy who's using dope. I'm better than you, and it's important that I feel that way even if you don't feel that way. And what I found out later, a lot of my friends are in the rooms now, is that they all felt that they were better than me. So it was kind of like delusional place setting. One guy told me at one point with actual deep concern in his voice, Oliver, I know a lot of people who can drink more than you, but I don't know anyone who gets as drunk as you. And he was trying to warn me. He was scared for me. He was a nice guy. And I took that as a compliment. I took that as, this guy doesn't know anyone who can drink as much as me. That's awesome. It's like, finally, I'm the best at something. That guy says that he's never met anybody who's as drunk as I am. That's wonderful. Another story I guess on that note talk about is my dad came out to visit me one time when I think I just turned 21, and we went to a restaurant for lunch, and I decided to have a drinking contest with him and not tell him, and he beat me. But I was like chugging the beers back as fast as I could, and my dad was just drinking slowly, and he still beat me. And I was like so proud of that because I knew that those are the genes I came from. Someday I'll be able to drink like that guy. That was my goal. My goal was to be the drunkest person you knew. I have no idea why that seemed like a good idea, but the delusions of the disease, I guess. Let me see. At some point, I moved out to New Mexico to finish college, and I was vaguely aware that there was something wrong. Like, I just knew the situation wasn't working out. I knew that a change of scenery might be in my best interest. I don't know how, on some level, I just knew that I needed to get healthy. I figured, if I go out to New Mexico, there's mountains, it's pretty, I go hiking. I get out to New Mexico, and I'll try and stick with alcohol here, but they have drive-through liquor stores in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and something like one-third of the drivers on a Friday night are drunk. I wasn't getting any better in New Mexico, and it wasn't getting any better whatsoever. And, you know, I was doing other things too, but New Mexico is where the consequences started to pile up. It's where I first got arrested. And the way my sponsor describes it is that when God needs your attention, you know, it starts with like a dull, like, knock or like a whisper until you don't hear it, and then it gets ratcheted up. So the pain got ratcheted up until I was willing to listen, right? Like, most alcoholics have been pretty badly mangled before they really commence to solve their problems, is what it says on page 43. That's certainly true in my experience. So the first time I get arrested, I'm 21 years old, and drinking at a party, and I pass out. Next thing I know, I'm getting slammed into a police cruiser with handcuffs put on me, the first time in my life. I found out later what happened is I passed out. My friends loaded me in the car. The guy who was driving was drunk. He had no plates on his vehicle. He ran a stop sign. Of course, the police pull him over. They find cocaine, marijuana in the vehicle, and alcohol. None of it's mine, so I'm fine. Everybody else in the car is getting charged with felonies. I'm getting a night in the drunk tank, me and my buddy Luke. They're like, you two didn't do anything other than be drunk. We're going to put you in the drunk tank, sober you up, and then off you go. You're in protective custody. Thanks. They throw us in the drunk tank with a bunch of guys who don't like gringos. I found in New Mexico what a gringo is. And they weren't too shy about letting us know they didn't like us. They were basically threatening to kill us in various graphic ways. And I can just remember, like, that they were going to, one guy was going to pull Luke's head off or something, and I was like, you do that, have fun. Yes. Good night. Yeah, I went to bed. It was right before I passed out. I woke up in the morning, and we were both still alive. There was no dead body in the room. And they were nice. They were really nice guys when we woke up sober in the morning in that holding tank. And we had this little mini quasi-AA meeting in that cell. We were all swapping war stories. What'd you do the night before to get here? Oh, you did that? Oh, that's crazy. I did this, too. And then they load us in the paddy wagon, take us out in the desert, and drop us off. I'm like, you guys seem like nice little college boys. You don't belong in here with us. I was like, whatever, I'm just like you. I'll see you soon. I mean, I'll be back. You know, we're friends. I mean, we're brothers. We're not from the same socioeconomic circumstances. We're people who normally wouldn't mix, but in that holding cell, you know, we shared something. We shared a moment. It was important. 5 months later, I was back in that cell, only I was alone this time. What happened is the girl who came to pick us up from the desert ended up becoming my girlfriend, which was unfortunate for her because I show up in the relationship. Wherever I go, there I am, right? And you hear the saying in the room, watch out for people, places, and things. Well, the people is whoever's around me, and the place is wherever I am, and the things are whatever's going on in my head or in my life, right? And so I really can't get to stay sober. I mean, I was sober when they dropped me off in the desert, got drunk as soon as I could after that, and drank with her, used her, took her hostage, tried that trick where I stabbed myself in the neck with her. It didn't work too well. She said she was thinking of leaving me one night when I was drunk because I drank too much. Stabbed myself in the neck with a pen a couple times, and she ran away even faster. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work out well. So she ran off with one of my friends, and I'm feeling sorry for myself about that. So I started drinking myself really into a blackout every single night, like, I don't know, a handle of vodka a night, something like that, maybe more. The night that's relevant here, where I got arrested again, I had a .28 BAC that I hadn't blacked out yet, and what I can remember is that I was cutting myself in the arms, so I wake up with like gashes all over my arms I didn't remember doing. This night, I cut myself down to the bone, and all this blood spurts out. I'm like, ooh, that was a mistake, and then I realized there's two white things in there. Oh, those are bones. I didn't know I had bones. I thought bones were something that happened to other people. I don't know. I guess, man, what do you know? Human biology works. Next thing I know is I'm thinking, like, you can't even die right. You're so useless. You're pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I had no idea what that phrase was, but that's exactly what I thought. This is a wave of it. Super drunk. .28 BAC. Screaming to whatever kind of God there is to come down and kill me. Life is useless. You can't even kill yourself. Come on, God. Come down here and kill me. Whatever you are, come kill me. Somebody in one of the other dorm rooms heard. They came over, tied a tourniquet around my arm, called 911. I stagger out of the room, bleeding all over the place. I get out the door, maybe make it about 50 yards. EMTs tackle me, load me on a gurney, take me to the hospital. I'm laughing at them the whole time, telling them their job's a joke, and as soon as I get out of the hospital, I'm going to finish my job, which was kill myself. They put me back in that holding cell for 24-hour psychiatric observation. And the first 6 hours, I could have done that time standing on my head because I'm drunk. And I'm blacked out. Immediately pass out as soon as I get in that cell. Those 6 hours are important to me now because they remind me that if I'm drunk, my circumstances don't matter. My life doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I'm in a mansion. It doesn't matter if I'm married to a beautiful woman. It doesn't matter if I'm in a jail cell. It doesn't matter if I'm living under a bridge. Nothing matters because I'm drunk and I have a solution, and my solution is alcohol. And King Alcohol works, right? Works in those moments. What's the saying in the 12 of 12? Alcohol is a rapacious creditor. What's a creditor? Well, a rapacious creditor is a creditor who breaks your legs when you don't pay him, right? But a creditor is also somebody who lends you money. So I get that $100 before you break my legs because I owe you $1,000. But I get the $100, right? That's what alcohol does for me. It fronts me an experience. It fronts me relief. That's why I go for it, because right now it's working. So the 6 hours, I'm in that jail cell, I'm fine. The next 18 hours, I'm sober. And I'm filled with, talks about it in the book as a terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, right? I can just describe it as I wished I were dead. I wished I was off this planet, filled with guilt and shame and fear, total fear and self-pity. And I talk my way out of that jail cell because sober, consumed with fear, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll talk my way out of that cell, no problem. And I talk my way out of getting kicked out of college, and no real bad consequences other than, you know, getting kicked off campus and having a nasty 16-stitch scar on my arm. And some nerve damage to my forearm, which doesn't really matter. And I moved back to Delaware. And then the pain gets ratcheted up again. Because at this point, I've decided to become a lawyer because I know that lawyers are well-respected and they make a lot of money and they buy top-notch booze. So in Delaware, I get arrested again. And this time, it's a little more serious. What happened is my sister brought this kid over that I didn't like too much. I just met him. I didn't like him. He rubbed me the wrong way. Some people just do that, you know. I say, Molly, don't bring this guy around again. So the next night, just as I'm polishing off like a pint of whiskey, he walks in the door with her. I've got a 12-pack of some crappy kind of beer, like Meister Brau or Schlitz or something, and I've got some good beer I'm saving in the fridge for the next day, Belgian, Blue Moon, Pale Ale, whatever it is. So I go in the room with this 12-pack and to drink alone, because that's what non-alcoholics do. People who can manage their drinking, control their drinking, and enjoy it, they drink alone. So I'm drinking alone, watching Casino in my room, polishing off these beers. He comes in, sits down next to me, and starts mouthing off about politics. He really liked this guy named Adolf Hitler. He really liked what Adolf Hitler did to the Jews. I really didn't agree with him, and I let him know that. No profanity, but I basically invited him to leave the house before I killed him. He left the room. I heard him thumping around out there, and then I had that intuition. He's going to take my beer. This Nazi is going to take my beer. The good beer is in the fridge. I don't care about the solution. The good beer is in the fridge. You're not getting my beer. Like I told you, there is a solution to my problems, and that solution is alcohol. You are not getting between me and my solution. I'm a cowardly, fearful, like little worm of a guy. When it comes to my solution, I'm as tough as they get, right? And I have literally walked through blizzards to get what I need. I've walked through snowstorms. I've walked on a twisted ankle for miles to get what I need. Like, I'm going to do that here. There's no way this guy's getting my booze. So I arm myself, right? I have a knife. It's about the size of my pinky, but I have a knife in my room that I pull out. Thank God I didn't have a gun or I'd probably still be in jail. So I go out there with this little knife, and I'm going to save my beer. I get behind him. He's in the dining room. I get to the kitchen, take the beer out of the fridge. I got the beer in the left hand, knife in the right hand. As I'm walking behind him, he said some things to me he shouldn't have said. Again, I don't want to cuss, but he basically dared me to stab him, which I shouldn't have done because I stabbed him a couple times. The knife broke, and he got cut a little bit. Not minimizing that. It was pretty serious, but I've never been more afraid in my life than when I stabbed that guy. I'll tell you that. It's amazing when you're afraid, but you know you have to do something because your ego is on the line, and I can't show fear. I just have to do it, and that's what I did, right? Long story short, it didn't work out well for him, and it didn't work out well for me. I got charged with two felonies, possession of deadly weapon during commission of a felony, and second-degree assault, which carries a minimum of 2 years and a maximum of 33 years in the state of Delaware. About a week later, I found out I got accepted into law school, and my dad's comment was, we don't know if you're going to go to jail or go to law school. Thanks, Dad. You know, you're funny. My lawyer didn't think it was very funny. He was like, you need to stop drinking. You need to stop drinking right now until the case is over with. Okay, Mr. Lawyer, here's your money. I'm consumed with fear, guilt, shame, self-pity, resentment. I was angry at that guy. I somehow had these like horrible murderous fantasies about him. Like, oh, I should have finished the job, and then he wouldn't be able to testify against me. Like, yeah, that would solve all my problems. Insanity. But I'm sober, right? Then I'm in this pizza shop with my mom and my brother after about 3 weeks of this. And they sell beer at this pizza shop. And the thought that crosses my mind is beer and pizza go well together. The thought that doesn't cross my mind is 2 to 33 years in prison. Because, again, you can have me for 2 to 33 years later if I can get drunk tonight. I need a solution, and I need it right now. Right now, this moment that we're in is the only moment that we have. This is the only moment that matters. This is the only moment that's real. And in this moment, I'm either moving moving towards God or I'm moving towards a drink, right? And in that moment, I had no relationship with God. Again, I thought if you believed in God, you were a moron. If you believed in any kind of personal relationship with God, I mean, prime mover kind of like conception, intellectual conception of God I was okay with. But if you believe in like a real relationship with God, you're an idiot. Booze works. My higher power is vodka, and that's what I do. I take a beer, and then I'm off to the races again. And somehow, no consequences. I plead guilty to a misdemeanor. I get into law school. I drink my way through law school. I had to see these alcohol counselors, psychologists, various shrinks and doctors, and I hate them all. I hate every single one of them because they're all smirking at me, telling me I have alcoholism and I can't control my drinking. I'm willing to concede that I'm an alcoholic, but not that I can't control my drinking. So they ask me to try, and I'll go a month sober, and then I'll be in a bar, which is a perfect place to stay sober, and the bartender won't serve me Pepsi, so I drink a beer. So it's his fault I pick up. It is always your fault when I pick up a drink. It's always your fault when something goes wrong in my life. My mom, I go visit her after 3 months sober, which proves I don't have a problem. And she has 10 different kinds of non-alcoholic beverages to drink, and she has beer. I drink a beer. My mom has dogs, and one of the dogs is a puppy, and the puppy dies. And I hear about this while I'm studying for the Pennsylvania bar exam. I'm halfway through the study period. I've been sober good 3 weeks now, probably. Good times. The dog died. You drink when a dog dies. I don't care what kind of heartless monster you are. A dog died. Come on, man. You ever see Lassie? You drink when Lassie dies. It's horrible. So I drink. And I drank for the rest of the study period. And I failed the Pennsylvania bar exam because of that puppy. It's that puppy's fault. I'm not a lawyer in Pennsylvania to this day. But I did do well enough on half the test. I could transfer the score to Vermont. So I take the Vermont bar, pass it, move up to Vermont. Mary Haas is along the way, some woman I barely know, but I'm drunk and it seems like a good idea at the time. We get to Vermont, neither one of us knows anybody, it's really cold, and we get an apartment above a guy whose heat we siphon because we can't afford heat. We live next door to a drug dealer, and I'm working at a convenience store selling booze and cigarettes for minimum wage at night, and by day clerking for free at the public defender's office. And this is as good as it gets for me, right? My wife can't work, by the way. She has a green card thing. I won't go into that. But the police keep asking, or something. The character fitness committee of the Board of Bar Examiners keeps asking me about stabbing people, cutting my arm open, all this stuff. I'm telling them the truth. And they asked me to come in for a meeting on December 1st of 2006. And I know that I need a couple weeks of clean time under my belt so that I can convincingly lie to them about how I don't have a problem with my drinking. And so November 9th of 2006, I drink the last of the beer in the house, last booze I've had between then and now in any form, which I'm aware, which was 2 beers. Really wasn't much. I go to bed, wake up, and look, my sobriety date is not my recovery date. I had every intention to keep drinking. As soon as this meeting was over and then I become a lawyer, I'm going to go tie one down, right? I'm gonna paint the town red. I'm going to get drunk for the rest of my life. I'm going to make $1 million a year. You're all going to know how great I am because I'll be a lawyer and I'll be rich and I'll have all the money for all the booze I want. So December 1st, I go in with that mindset, and it didn't work out that way. There's a judge there and 2 lawyers and 2 civilians, and they're all smirking at me. And they basically tell me in no uncertain terms that you've shown no evidence of character rehabilitation, no evidence of treatment of your obvious alcohol problem, and what are you going to do about it? You've shown no evidence you intend to do anything about it. The practice of law is a sacred and well-respected profession. If we let you become a lawyer, you're going to get drunk and stab somebody. You can get drunk and shoot somebody. You can get drunk and run somebody over with your car. And we really can't have that because lawyers, again, are well-respected. And I'm sitting there arguing with them about it. I have a transcript of this experience. It's great. It's great reading. At one point, I say to them, yeah, I know I'm an alcoholic, and obviously that doesn't go away, but don't worry. It's under control now. My wife has been really supportive, which is basically saying, my life's not unmanageable because I'm married. And I had no idea what that's basically what I said to them. No wonder they were smirking at me. Everything else that had happened to me sort of zipped right by my head and didn't really kick in. It didn't have any depth and weight when people would tell me to stop drinking at any of that. This time it had depth and weight. It hit me right in the center mass, right in the heart, because I always thought I was the best, smartest, nicest guy in the room, and that's how I saw myself. And yeah, I stabbed people, and yeah, I hurt people, but if you had my problems, you would too, and it's their fault. It's always your fault when somebody gets hurt. If you get hurt, it's your fault. That's how I saw it. And the way that they saw me wasn't like that. It was like they held up a mirror to me, and I saw that I was, in fact, a dangerous, violent, unpredictable lunatic that can't be trusted with any responsibility. And it was like in that moment, I realized what alcohol had done to me. And I couldn't blame you for what alcohol had done to me. I had to blame my consumption of alcohol and my life for what was done. And it was like alcohol was my God. Alcohol was my savior. And alcohol in that moment became this false prophet that had led me out into the spiritual wasteland to die. And I just knew that if I kept drinking, I had nowhere to go but down. And it was like the scales fell from my eyes in that moment. And it was pretty miserable, But I said to my wife after the hearing, look, they're not going to let me become a lawyer. That's okay. I'm going to go to those AA meetings, and I'm going to do whatever those people tell me to do. Because I knew about your program. I knew about your fellowship. I hated it, and I hated you. I hated you all. No offense. I'd gone to a meeting when I was 20. Basically, there was a crackhead in Maryland who used to... I would buy booze because I was stealing to get vodka. So I'd give him money. He'd give me some vodka. He'd buy crack, whatever. He was trying to get sober. And he said, why don't you come to this AA meeting with me? I'll buy you some vodka afterward. I was like, okay, sure. And vodka, all right. So we go to this meeting, and people are talking about God, solution, recovery. And I'm just thinking, I hate you all. I hate everybody in this room. You're crazy. I have a solution. They sell it at the liquor store. It's called vodka. Vodka, 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 vodka. When will you shut up so I can get some vodka? The end of that meeting, he says, what'd you think? And I said, I think you owe me some vodka. So he went and bought me some vodka, and off we went. 8 years later, I walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where I'm actually willing to listen to what people have to offer because I've been beaten into a state of reasonableness by this disease. And I'm not looking for vodka anymore. I'm looking for answers. And I had nothing but problem, and you offered me solution. Because I went to that meeting December 3rd, 2006, and people were talking about fear, and people were talking about anger, and people were talking about the things that ran my life, but they weren't like me anymore. They had this light on in their eyes, and they would talk about, like, yeah, I did this, and then I did that, and it worked out. And I couldn't quite follow what they were saying. It seemed like a lot of God talk and a lot of prayer and all that, but I'm willing to do anything at this point. I'm willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. That's all I know, right? So you're just like me, but you're not like me anymore. What is it that you did to get to be the way you are now? Because clearly you were like me, and at this moment, I want to literally blow my brains out, and you are not like that. You seem happy. Yeah, happy, joyous, and free, like it talks about in the big book. That's how they were, right? And it says on page 153, the age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. And that's what I saw in those people. That's what I saw in you. And so I raised my hand and said, I'm a newcomer. And a guy came up to me, gave me a big book. Read the first 164 pages, get back to me. I did. I read the first 164 pages in about 2 days. Called him back, never heard from him. It doesn't matter. I got at that meeting, I got found out about a meeting that was closer to my house that became my home group. And I started going there every day. And at that meeting, I found a man who became my sponsor. And he took me through the steps. He took me through the work. He had me volunteer, get a service commitment, make that my home group, set up, you know, chairs, make coffee, sweep them off the floor, which is a lot of fun in Vermont. Just do these little anonymous tasks, these thankless tasks that make this whole thing work. And, you know, just doing that gave me a sense of purpose, right? Even as a newcomer, even as somebody who hadn't done any of the steps yet. And then we started working the steps, right? I don't know. I didn't go through too much of that, but I'll tell you about my four-step, I guess, my first four-step. So I'm at this meeting, right, and it's a good meeting, pretty good meeting. There's that guy sharing. He's sharing about the solution all the time. He's great. And then my sponsor shares. He's wonderful. I love my sponsor. And then that guy shares. He's good. And then she shares, and I don't care what she says. She's beautiful. Like, you're just beautiful. Just be you. Just come. I don't care what you say. I love you. I'm married, but, yeah, no worries. I wish you were here. Yeah. Then that one guy shares, and I hate that man. I absolutely, utterly loathe and despise him. I want him to die in a fire. I want to be the one that starts that fire. Him and that judge at that hearing, Ben Joseph, I hated that man too. I would think about him all the time while I'm reading this four-step. And I wanted Ben Joseph to die in a fire. And frankly, if I met Ben Joseph now, I would thank him for saving my life because that's what he did with that December 1st meeting we had. But anyway, getting back to this meeting, I hate this guy. Some of you might feel this by now, actually, which I don't blame you if you do. I would fantasize about ninjas jumping out of the ceiling and chopping his head off. I'd fantasize about mass gum and coming in the room and blowing his brains out and leaving. I would just sit there in the back of the room and just think this over and over and over. One day, I remember he was sharing, and he would just share about his problems. He'd bitch about his cat or whatever it was, wine. I remember I fantasized about a nuclear war for this five-minute chair. I got really graphic in my mind. The Russians set off a nuclear weapon over Lake Champlain, and the shockwave comes roaring across the lake, vaporizing it, hitting all the buildings in Burlington, Vermont, blowing them to pieces, coming into this church, hitting this basement, killing us all, blowing us all apart like burnt leaves, killing everybody in Vermont, killing everybody in America, killing everybody in the world. And I remember praying to a God that I didn't understand what he was yet. Please, God, make it happen. Kill me. Kill me right now. Kill everybody in this room right now. Kill us all. Kill everybody in America right this minute. Just shut this man up. Shut him up right now, God. Kill me. Kill me. Kill me. And then I went to my sponsor later and said, I'm in trouble with this four-step because I really don't think I have any resentments. Apparently wanting everybody in the world to die in a fiery nuclear apocalypse is in fact a resentment of some sort. And I found that out that day. So then I go in and do this fist up with him, and I'm convinced that he's got my back. He's my sponsor. He's my buddy, right? So it's his job to tell me that I'm right and that I'm a victim and that you've wronged me. and that, you know, I guess we're supposed to go out and break your legs together or something. I don't know. That's what I thought. I found out that actually it was all my fault. When I was mad at you, it was actually something I did. I felt kind of betrayed. I guess I probably should have read the big book a little more thoroughly before I did this four-step thing, because I was kind of thorough and like, what do you mean? I thought you were my friend. So he gets through tearing me apart in this fifth step, showing me how I'm a liar, a thief, a cheat, a phony, and all this other stuff. And then he says, you want this stuff lifted out of you? I'm like, sure, I know what that means. Like, yeah, sure, why not? All right, get on your knees and pray with me right now. Okay. And, I don't know what that, okay. So he gets on his knees, and I look down at him, and I feel bad saying this, but I have to. I mean, it's part of my truth. My truth is that I'm a bigot. My truth is that I'm a homophobe. And I have to talk about that because, you know, it's sad reality of my experience at that point was I didn't know that I was homophobic, but I was. And I found out in that moment that I was because my sponsor was a wonderful, kind man, a true agent of God who did God's work and helped the newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. He also happened to be gay. And so he said, get on your knees and pray with me. And the thought that went through my head in that instant that I have to remember and have to talk about was that he's going to try and have sex with me down there. But the next thought that went through my head was, I'll do anything for victory over alcohol. I'll do anything. And so, you know, my sponsor now talks about this. He says that, like, if you go up to somebody and ask them to sponsor you, you're basically asking, what is it that you did for victory over alcohol? And then they tell you, and you have to go and do it. And if they told you, I went over that wall and yelled Hare Krishna at it three times, you can think to yourself, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. But if you want what they have, you will do what they do. And Alcoholics Anonymous is not a program of thinking. It's a program of action. And so you'll go over that wall and you'll Hare Krishna at it three times. And so I got on my knees and I said the seven-step prayer with that man. And I had a spiritual experience that I can't describe. And I haven't had the desire to drink since I did that. I mean, I had cravings before that. Since then, I've had thoughts of drinking, but I've also had thoughts of, you know, suicide. And but they're never the urge, never the craving, like I need a drink right now. That was lifted out of me in that moment. And I pray to God that it never comes back. And I have to keep doing this work to make sure it doesn't come back. And it's a miracle it didn't. I'll get into that real quick. So I go through the rest of the steps with my sponsor as best I can. The miracles start happening in AA, and that's the problem with AA, is that it works, right? It says on page 85 that it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day, then, we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly, and they didn't with me. I stopped that, right? Because the problem today is that it works. So let me go into that real quick. I get admitted to practice law in the state of Vermont. So now I'm a lawyer. My attorney becomes my boss, and so I start working an hour south of Burlington, where I live. And so I stop using that as my home group. My sponsor moves away. I get a new sponsor who quickly fires me. And then I get a better sponsor who is named Oliver, and he lives in my head. I love that guy. He's a great sponsor. Everything I want to do is good to go. I'm glad we had this little chat sponsor. And then at 2 years sober, I get this pardon from this woman named Ruth Ann Minner, who happens to be governor of Delaware at the time. She pardons me for stabbing that Nazi and all this other stuff. So now I'm really unfettered, right? But at the same time, I have like a God shot from that because all of a sudden I'm not a criminal anymore. And before that, if you push me past a certain point, one of us is getting hurt, and it might be me at the end, but it's going to be you in the beginning, because I will hurt you to show you that I'm tough, because I'm afraid, I'm dominated by what you think of me, I'm consumed by fear of every human interaction, so I don't want to fight you, I don't want to hurt you, I don't want to be hurt, but if you push me too far, that's going to happen, and I walked around for years thinking, I am a criminal, this is what criminals do. When I got that pardon, it was like that was lifted right out of me. I don't feel that way anymore. I don't have to be a criminal. I can be just another bozo on the bus. I can be another worker among workers. Anyone in the room who might have a criminal record might be able to relate to those feelings, might not. Your mileage may vary. I'm just telling you, this is my experience. And so I had that pardon. So I have a pardon, and I'm a lawyer now, right? Things are going great. I have a good sponsor. He tells me whatever I want to hear. And mostly what he tells me is that I can cut back on AA meetings. So I go from 5, 6, 7 meetings a week to 2, maybe 4 in a good week, usually 2, sometimes 1, whatever. You know, I'm coming to these meetings, I'm not doing any steps, I'm not praying, why would I do that? I'm not sponsoring anybody, who would want what I have anyway, right? I just go to meetings, and I start thinking about women other than my wife. Long story short, after about 3 years as a lawyer in Vermont, I leave Vermont, leave my marriage, move to Maryland to chase after other women, because at this point, I have no God of my understanding, right? I have other solutions, not alcohol and not drugs, but other things in my life that work for me in those capacities, right? It says on page 53 that when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition either God is everything or else God is nothing. God either is or isn't. What was our choice to be? And I guess I decided that God could, my God was pretty small at that point. My atheism was pretty writ large. And at that point, I, would have argued with you and said, I'm not an atheist, but I was functionally an atheist, right? You know, Lois Wilson supposedly said that fear is a subtle form of atheism, and fear ran my life, right? Emmett Fox said that to be afraid is to have more faith in evil than in God. I certainly had a lot of faith in fear at that point, a lot of faith in evil, because that's what I was doing. I was hurting people around me, doing things that really shouldn't have done. Discrediting AA in the process, I might add, because some of the women I was chasing after were married, and they talked to their therapist, and their therapist would say, that guy's in AA, and he does that? And looking back on it, I owe an immense to Alcoholics Anonymous for the things I did, you know? And I realized that later, because that makes that therapist think that AA doesn't work, that AA is garbage, that people in AA act like this. Why would I send one of my clients who's struggling with alcoholism to that, snake's nest? Why would I send them there? Because there's men like that in AA, and that's who I was, and that's my truth, and that's my experience, and it's not something I'm proud of, but it is what it is, right? I'm going to meetings. I'm going to the sickest meetings I can find, about one or two a week in Maryland. My favorite meetings are the ones where everybody shares about their problems, because I feel better than you when you share about your problems, because I have a good job, and I'm a lawyer in a different state, but I have a good job. You are complaining about your probation officer and how he's a jerk, or you're complaining about how your girlfriend just dumped you, or you're complaining about how you're living behind a dumpster, or you're complaining about how you are on parole for drug offenses and how you just failed your analysis and how you're going back to prison. And I listen to those stories and I feel great because I feel better than you. And I'm right back to where I was when I was drinking, right? And it occurred to me, I had this little mini epiphany in one of these meetings, that I could be in a bar having the same conversation, having these same interactions. Yeah, my life is horrible. Have a shot. My life's worse than yours. Have a shot. You think your lives are bad? Listen to mine. Have a shot. I was never once in a bar where I heard somebody say, I'm so grateful to be alive, I'm so grateful for the gift of recovery and freedom, that the next round is on me. I'm just so grateful to be doing God's work in this world. Henrietta, the Lord has been so good to me, curing me of this terrible illness, I wish we keep talking about it and helping people. That's what Bill Wilson says, page 191. Nobody ever said that in a bar right before they ordered me around. That just never happened. But I've heard people complain and whine and one up on another in the self-pity department all the time. Anyway, long story short, I lose the job in Maryland because I show up. At this point, I'm just an angry guy. When they let me go, they took me outside because they were worried that I was going to throw a chair through a window, apparently. And so I end up, long story short, ending up back in my mom's house at 35 years old with no girlfriend, no job, no solution to speak of, and just I hit this bottom sober in 2012. I had a lot of time. I was happy to tell you about that. I have over 5 years sober. But I end up taking the Delaware bar because I have nothing else to do. I'm just done, right? So I take the Delaware bar. I pass it using the things you taught me how to use, like the techniques of staying sober and working for what I want. And then I get a sponsor as part of the process of getting admitted to practice law in Delaware. And this sponsor introduces me to this thing I've forgotten about called Alcoholics Anonymous. And real quick, I'm going to read you something that was read to me when I was almost 6 years sober. It's on page 25 of the big book. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we have been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven. We have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence which we had not even dreamed. At almost 6 years sober, somebody read that paragraph to me, and I thought it was talking about spaceships. We've been rocking to a, blah, 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 blah. We've been rocking to a fourth dimension of existence which we've not even dreamed. It's talking about spaceships. That was the realization I had because I didn't know anything about this book. But this sponsor, he has me go to these meetings where people don't talk about their cat running into their lawnmower and breaking it, or their pet rock running away from them, or their probation officer being a jerk. These people talk about their problems, but they mostly talk about their solution and how that solution is found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how they're working that solution and the miracles it's brought about in their lives. And they're talking about this, and I'm listening to them, and I'm like, oh yeah, I vaguely remember this from, when I was a newcomer. This is what AA is. This is actually what it's about. And my sponsor's taking me back through this work. and I start to feel better. Things start to work out in my life. Some of the, really, just materially, things start to work out. It says in the book on page 64 that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And in my case, that was materially as well. Not that that matters very much, because really, the problem in my life, my whole life, is that I have no relationship with God because I'm completely choked off by self. And I had no idea my entire life. And so if I'm not trying to deal with the anger and the fear and the self-pity that results from that loss of relationship with alcohol, then I'm doing it with other things, like women or work or money or prestige or just obsessing over insanity. And going back to the work with my sponsor, we unblock that channel as best we can. And my sponsor has me getting back on my knees and praying and doing all these other things you taught me how to do, and he taught me how to do. And then at one point, he has me start sponsoring people. First, I'm like, I don't know, why don't I have any sponsors? And he says, nobody wants what you have. Yeah, that's true. Then later on, I say, why don't I have any sponsors? And he says, well, you have a great message, but you never share it. Nobody knows what you have because you don't talk about it. You know? And the way I see it now is that if God lights a fire in you, you're not supposed to bury that fire. You're not supposed to, like, hide it. That fire is supposed to shine forth. Because if I'm a newcomer and I come into these rooms desperate and broken down and looking for an answer to my problems, I'm going to look for the people who are shining, the ones who have the light on in their eyes, the ones who are offering that solution. I'm going to go and reach out to them. I want what you have, right? So, well, I had that at this point, I guess, according to my sponsor, but nobody knew it. So I start sharing. And then the terrifying part is people start asking me to sponsor them. I have no idea how to sponsor anybody. I have no idea to this day. I'm like, I don't know. There's this book here. Why don't you do what this book says? It's like a blueprint. It's a design for living, it says. Let's check this out. Let's do what it does. And we go through this book, me and the guys who actually do the work. And the amazing thing is that the ones who do it get the results. I remember the first time I heard another man's fifth step. And then we went through the work, do the seven-step prayer. He had the same experience I had. He straightens out. The lights are on in his eyes. And I had this realization. I had this epiphany. The age of miracles truly is still with us. His own recovery proves that to me, right? It says on page 159, these men had found something brand new in life. Though they knew they must have other alcoholics, they would remain sober. That motive became secondary. It was transcended by the happiness they found in giving themselves for others. That was my experience in that moment. In that moment, it was like the lights were finally on, and I finally understood that I, too, had recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And that I, too, had had this experience. And before that, I didn't exactly believe in it. I did the work, but I didn't quite believe in it. I didn't accept it. I sort of thought on some level that I was just doing this for selfish motives, that I was doing this to get and stay sober, and I had to help you because that's the only way I can do that. But in that moment, I understood that this really works, and that I'm a small but important part of a miracle. And I finally understood what that meant, right? And that's still my experience today. The joy of living we really have, right? That's what we get. That's what we get. That's what's so wonderful about being a sponsor. When the new person comes up to you so beaten down that they're spiritually completely dead, and sometimes they've been physically dead a couple times, and they ask you to sponsor them. And first, you know they're sick because they need you as their sponsor. And they're like, oh man, this guy's really messed up. But then he does the work and he gets the results. If he does the work, he gets the results. And I'm really just there to show him what I did and to watch him put his hand in the hand of God of his understanding, right? And the ones that do the work, it's amazing. Like, you get to step 12 with them. You start getting, like, all these, like, text messages and Facebook messages and people coming up to you at random events and hugging you and saying, thank you for giving me back my son. Thank you for giving me back my brother. Thank you for giving me back, you know, my whatever, my husband. And you're like, who are you? Who is this person? I don't know. Why are you hugging me? Why are you writing me on Facebook? Who are you? Oh, that's right. You're some name I read on a four-step a while ago. I never met you before. I just remember your name on a four-step. And we did the fifth step. He talked about you. And then when he was talking about his ninth step, I made some suggestions. That's all you are to me. But I can see how much his recovery means to you. Now I finally understand that this program of recovery doesn't just work for the people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it works in the lives of everybody whose lives touch the sufferers, right? Like it says on page 18, there's that negative tornado effect where I delude myself into thinking that I'm only hurting myself, but the fact of the matter is, if you're close to me while I'm out there drinking, you're getting hurt too. Or if you're close to me while I'm in untreated alcoholism, while I'm sober, wishing I were dead, and approaching every interaction, like, what can I take from this interaction? Where I'm looking at everybody around me like there's somebody I can steal joy from, energy from, whatever I want from. You're getting hurt too. And the delusion I tell myself is I'm only hurting myself. Well, when we go through the work, when we recover, When we make these nine-step amends, the people around us get to recover too. They get to see a new man or a new woman standing before them. And it makes no sense. You know, the old doctrine group literature, they talk about it as a changed life. It's manifested through restitution. And the person who the amends is being made to rubs their eyes and wonders if the world is going crazy or if it's becoming incredibly sane. And that's what it is. You come to me and make an amends, and I just think of you as some scumbag who wronged me. And you're coming to me and you're saying, I wronged you. What can I do to make it right? Here's some money, I owe you more. What am I supposed to make of that other than this is a changed man, and whatever this man is doing needs to keep doing? The world is either going crazy, because I've never had an experience like this before in all probability, or the world is going sane. And that's why these people are coming up to me and thanking me. It has nothing to do with me, but they don't know that. They don't understand that. Nobody has to understand that this thing works or how it works. All they have to know is that their alcoholic relative is now recovered and is doing God's work, right? All right, I'm glad I've got through all that. I have a couple minutes. I'd like to talk about 10, 11, and 12 real quick. You know, my sponsor, one of the things he has me do is read 84 to 88 on a daily basis. And it talks in page 84 about how we should continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, not if, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. See, my problem is that I'm not cured of alcoholism, and I'm still a selfish, self-centered, fear-driven person, right? Because I'm constantly saying to God, thanks, God, thanks, A, I've got it from here. I'll take over. Or, yeah, God, you can have my recovery, and you can have my work. When it comes to relationships with women, I'm in charge, God. And so I'm circumscribing God, and then I'm wondering why certain areas of my life were unmanaged or why I'm miserable. And I can do that all the time. I can leave here spiritually on fire, and the first time the car cuts me off, I'm fantasizing about how that driver should die because he makes me afraid for my life, and the only way I know how to express fear is through homicidal rage. I need to turn that over to God because I've already blocked off that channel. That channel that we put so much work into opening gets blocked off in an instant, right? 10th step keeps it open. And when I keep that channel open, I can work the 11th step effectively. And the 11th step is about widening that channel, right? Through prayer and meditation. And people used to ask me about that. I used to talk about that. I didn't know what meditation was until really within the last year or two of Alcoholics Anonymous, of my spiritual journey. I always thought that meditation was emptying your mind and you know, sitting cross-legged in a cave. And if that works for you, then more power to you. It does not work for me. I can't do it. I just can't do it. I can't empty my mind. This little brain in my skull just doesn't shut up ever. It just spitfire all the time. All the time. Whether good thoughts, bad thoughts, and different thoughts. And really, this is where the problem begins and where the problem ends for me. So how do I deal with that? Well, what they would do in the old days in the Oxford group and the early days of AA is they would pray to God in the morning, right? They'd get on their knees and open a channel to God, which is like talking to God, like, hey, God, how are you? Good morning. You know, call on the phone. But if I just do that, which is what I did for a while, and then hang up the phone, I'll see you tonight, click. And then tonight I call, hey, God, thanks for the good day. Bye, click. That's my relationship with God. Prayer, no meditation. Oh, forget it. That'd be like if I called you up at 6 o'clock in the morning and said to you, hey, how you doing? Here's what I need today. Thanks. And help this guy too. Thanks. Bye. Click. That's not a good relationship, especially if that's the only interaction we have. I ring in your doorbell and run away. Or I just call you and then hang up the phone. Don't listen. Meditation is listening. And what I've been shown how to do recently is that I should write down the thoughts that come. After I open that channel, and I'm thinking thoughts to God in prayer, I'm talking to God in prayer, then maybe the next thoughts that come are God's answer to that prayer. And, there's a saying in the old days, they would talk about how when man listens, God speaks, and how when man obeys, God acts, right? And so I'll write down thoughts that come after I pray. I'll just write them down for 3 or 5 minutes, just whatever comes. And a lot of it is selfish, and a lot of it is self-centered, a lot of it is not from God. But what they would do in the old days, they'd write down all their crazy thoughts, not censoring any of them. Then they compare them to the four absolutes of the doctrine group, which are absolute honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. And they would run this by a sponsor or a sharing partner, which is what I do now. I share this stuff with people in my life every day. And they can point out to me where I'm being selfish, where I'm not living up to those absolutes. So help a newcomer, text my sponsees, go to a meeting, be of service. Hit on that hot girl. It's like one of these doesn't come from God. Which one is it? Be of service. Help my mom clean the house. Kill my boss. Reach out to that new guy. One of these is not from God, right? It's not hard to figure out. But the problem I've had my entire life is that I'm driven by delusions. I can constantly tell myself that what I'm doing is right. I could steal your money And by the time I'm out the door, think that I've done you a favor by stealing it, right? So I need to run this stuff by people because I'm still as crazy as they come. And so that brings us to the 12th step. Well, do it, right? Just do it. And if you take these actions, you will get these results. And any time that I'm consumed by self, consumed by fear, consumed by self-pity, I'll turn that stuff over to God in the 10th step. Sometimes that doesn't work even because it's so entrenched. But if I reach out to a newcomer, I'm thinking about their problems, and I'm thinking about what I can offer to help this person. All of a sudden, I'm not thinking about myself anymore. Bill Wilson talked about it on page 15, how he'd go to the hospital in despair, and I'm talking to a newcomer there, he'd be amazingly lifted up and set on his feet. And that's been my experience, too. If I have more time, I'd go into all the miracles I've seen in my life. Transform men, transform women I've seen. God, I talk about this all night. Frankly, I'd rather talk about my sponsees and myself, and even former sponsees, some guys like... We're talking about this on the write-up. One of my sponsees made amends to somebody who assaulted him, and the guy who assaulted him then picked him up off the ground and drove him to the emergency room. And just like, but to see this guy and to know the kind of person he is and how fear-driven he was his entire life, and to see how he acted in that moment, and to see how he's willing to take a beating from somebody to get a better relationship with God and to make it right to that person, and how even after that, the guy took him to the hospital. It's like, I don't even know how to describe that. I don't know how to describe that situation. I had a sponsee one time who went to make an amends to his aunt while I was waiting for him at a restaurant. And he came back and said that she'd given him a car. How's that happen? It's all coincidence, really. There are no coincidences in this world, but that's the joke, obviously. If we take these actions, we will get these results. Again, if there's nothing else that you get out of what I have to say tonight, it's... that I've taken the actions that you show me how to take, and I've gotten these results. And real quick, I'll talk about my material circumstances, I guess, because my sponsor told me that it matters a little bit. I really don't think it does because it's a way to compare outward. It doesn't really matter. Again, all my own power, I am, cirrhotic liver, unemployable, rotting in a jail cell, or dead by now. But thanks to what you have taught me how to do, I have a job today. I have a badge in my wallet. I'm admitted to practice law in the state of Delaware. I worked for the government agency that prosecuted me, was trying to lock me up for 2 to 33 years. They promoted me 4 times in the last 4 years and given me an award. I have a house because God needs me to have a house because it's a good place to hear fifth steps. I have a car because God needs me to have a car because when I have a car, I can go places like this and I can be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I have these things because God needs me to have them. And if God doesn't need me to have them, they'll be taken away from me because, again, of myself, I am nothing. It's really just... when I reach out to help the people around me, that I get these results, right? And the most important thing I have today is a relationship with God of my understanding and a network of other men that I can trust with anything today. True friendship, a true and meaningful friendship, not the kinds of friendship that I used to find in the bars and, parties and whatnot. I'm just fair weather friends. I don't really give a you know what. All right, I guess I'm out of time. I'd like to thank you all for your service tonight. I'd like to thank you for everything you've done for me. And if there's anything I can do to help anybody in this room, please let me know, because anything I can do for you is nothing compared to what you've done for me. You've saved my life, and I owe you my life. And for that, I'm very grateful. Thank you.